great pleasure to introduce Billy.
My name is Billy. I'm an alcoholic. And I know what it's like to be wasted. And I'm grateful to Marcus for asking me to speak tonight. I'm going to share a little bit about, like, say I was born. On the day I was born, I had four sisters. By the time I was 6 years old, I had eight sisters. And by the time I was 8 years old, I had a brother. And there was 10 of us. And there was crucifixes and pictures all over the walls and statues, a gigantic statue of Mother Mary in the hallway, and just all this everywhere. And we prayed the rosary every night. And if our dad was around, we prayed kind of a normal pace. And if our dad wasn't there, we prayed really fast. Like if there was some reason, sometimes someone gets up here and they read the 12 and, the chapter 5. You know, they just read it like time matters or something. We used to pray the rosary like that. And anyhow, so as a child, like probably 7, 8, 9 years old, something like that, I had what I call an unbreakable, unshakable love of God. It was a connection that it was like someday I want to grow up and be able to share that. And I was named after a priest across the street from where we lived in Seattle. The whole city block was a Catholic Girls Academy, Holy Names Academy. And I was totally surrounded by women. And I remember just a few things of growing up, like when I was, like say, tall enough to pee in a toilet, however, whatever age that was. Okay, well, there came a time when probably one of my sisters came and said, Billy, when you use the toilet, you put the seat up. Okay, so the next time one of my sisters popped by when I was using the bathroom, I was sitting on porcelain, holding myself from falling in because boys put the seat up. So it took me a while to get the picture. You don't always put the seat up. Okay. And that's just a little snapshot of life in that realm that I grew up in. I'm going to fast forward to prayer life. And anyone here, if you don't pray, that's fine. More than likely, sometime you'll find yourself open to it and let it come to you. If you're not praying, don't feel bad about it, but I highly recommend it. It's a great prayer that I learned along the way was, use the word God, but you don't have to. But it's, please reveal yourself to me as you exist for me, and that's the whole prayer. And so honestly, if I'm saying to a higher power, if there is a higher power, please reveal yourself to me as you exist for me, then I don't have to study your way of believing or your way of believing. But what that prayer did for me was it made it clear it's not my job to understand God. It's God's job, or my higher power's job, to show me my higher power. But my job is to pay attention. If I experience a blessing, call it a blessing. If I experience a gift, call it a gift. If I experience some kind of grace, call it grace. Okay. I graduated high school. That's my prayer life. I start the day, I'm like on my knees, and I pray probably, I don't use a timer, but I count off gifts. And there's like, joy, peace, love, patience, insight, understanding, clarity, imagination, inspiration, willingness, perseverance, growth in perspective and perception. Mercy, compassion, empathy, forgiveness, trust, trustworthiness, integrity, honesty, generosity, kindness. There's a whole bunch. I mean, I don't spend time trying to think of it all because that would take too long. But and I wind up with for faith, hope, and grace. And the point of those thank yous is like filling my cup in the morning, reminding me of what my life experience is like, the gifts that I've gotten in sobriety. You know, we all have the opportunity to experience patience. Oh yeah, and humility is another one. I'm really proud of my humility. And when people say you shouldn't say that or whatever, okay, there was a Franciscan guy in Santa Barbara that was 6 months sober, whatever, and he was saying you shouldn't be proud of being humble, something like that. Or if you even recognize that you're being humble, that you're that's a blasphemy, so to speak. And the reality is, you can experience humility, like standing right here, right now. I'm going to be jumping all over the place, and I'll stop at 9-ish, unless you ask for an encore. Standing here right now, and just because I'm sober, okay, and it's because I have, it's like every one of us here, Adrian and Brent and Teresa, who's named after one of my sisters, when we get to Alcoholics Anonymous, and a lot of you here that have been here a while, it's like we're driving a car, like I'm driving a car, and my windshield is full of bugs, okay? And I'm on this pathway, this highway of my life, and my windshield's full of bugs. My life doesn't make any sense. What am I doing? And I may as well drink. I'm not going anywhere, okay? Well, through the steps, we get the windshields off the bugs. You're going to wind up with a clear windshield where you're going to see the pathway of your life. A little bit of a time. I don't see the whole pathway of my life. That's crazy. But I see the pathway of my life in the next 40 minutes, you know? And I'll tell you a little bit about the pathway to here since Marcus asked me to share about 3 or 4 days ago. Holy smokes, man. I've had almost like no sugar, no cookies, no pie, no ice cream. All that stuff messes up with how I connect the dots up here, and I didn't want to be like a total zombie up here. And anyhow, my higher power guided me, you know. So after saying thank you a lot for my loved ones, for my mom and my dad, these are booklets that I was able to put together because I answered the phone at central office when I was about 7 or 8 years sober in Santa Barbara. I answered the phone for 4 hours once a week. And there's a guy walking in and out, and he was bald, and he was pulling his hair out. And he had been the treasurer for 3 years, and nobody that was associated with central office would step up to do it. And my higher power said, Billy, you can do that. And I said, I can do that. And so at the age of 41, 2, or 43, I became the treasurer at the central office down there. And the treasurer had this stuff in an Excel spreadsheet in like 1991, 92. And for those of you that don't know what a spreadsheet is, it's like columns and rows, like our resentment list, right? Those three columns that we do our resentments on. Okay, so a spreadsheet is however many columns you need and then how many rows. So there's income and expenses and where the money came from and who we paid the money to and all that stuff. That's what a spreadsheet is, okay? So the treasurer had it in a spreadsheet on a computer. Myself, up until that time, I thought computers were for people who couldn't figure things out in the head because I had it all figured out. They just got these rectangles in of leather and sew zippers on them, and you make zipper pouches and handbags. I had it really going on. Mm-hmm. And my point of that is to be willing to say yes to life, to things that you don't know how to do. I said yes to it. My sponsor had a computer, so with his help, and he was an accountant with the County of Santa Barbara. Eventually, I got a computer. And then I learned some graphics. And then I made that card with a photo that a friend of mine had given to me when I was drinking, in my drinking days. And I made that card because my higher power said to make that card. I had a card that said, one day at a time, Billy N, 805-96732, whatever my number was back then. And from that experience, it grew into this, to be able to do this. So I thank my higher power for my mom, for my dad, for 8 sisters and my brother. And I thank my higher power for those people in my life. Thank you for my nieces and nephews. I don't have kids, by the way. I was never married, and I'll get around to that. But niece and nephews, great niece and nephews, great great niece and nephew in-laws, and step niece and nephews. And one of my aspirations in life is to be able to send fudge, but I'm going to need help in my business to do that, is to send fudge to each of my nieces and nephews on their birthdays, which I do with some of them that I know fairly well. But I'd like to send them all, you know, it's a card and pick your favorite fudge and so on their birthday. Then connected to my parents, I won't go into a whole lot, but my grandparents, aunts and uncles, and cousins. And then I thank my higher power for my ancestors all the way back, because I am descendant of something, okay? And what I'm expressing to you is awareness that I didn't have when I was a guy in the photo on that card, okay? Now, standing here, I thank God I was alive for the James Webb, or the Hubble telescope, and I'm alive for the James Webb telescope. Some of you have seen those images, and some of you have not seen those images. Okay, but the reality, the truth is where the reality, where I am standing right here, right now, right over there, there's an unspeakably gorgeous galaxy. And there's one there, way over there. Everywhere you look in your mind's eye is inexpressible beauty. If this dissolved and we could see this place where we truly are, we wouldn't be able to speak. And I'm conscious of that. Not every minute, I don't always have that on my mind. But if I'm in a troubled moment or doubtful or whatever, I recognize, where am I at? You know, this place is unspeakably beautiful, okay? So let me back up. Okay, I graduated high school in 1967. The Vietnam War was going on. I was student body president, had the top SAT score in the high school. At the various occasions through high school, when one or more of my sisters were getting married, I had the opportunity to drink, and I drank until I was cut off, but I never chased it. I went to City College. I remember a sign on the wall in the cafeteria that said, "Of all sad things of tongue and pen, the saddest are what might have been." And I was like, well, I hope that's never true for me, you know? And I've been brought back to life. And now I'm walking in the shoes of the man I thought I would be when I was a child. But I was, of all sad things of tongue and pen, the saddest are what might have been. And I'm just saying that as an invitation. I'm trying to reach to your spirit, right? To reach in deep inside and just like let your light shine, you know? And if I graduated high school, the war was going on. At one point, I was student deferment for a while, and then eventually I got my draft notice, or my physical notice for the draft, and I passed my physical, and I got a telegram from the Marine Corps on a Friday, and it said, join the Marines now because you're going to be drafted on Monday. So on Monday, I went down to selective service, and I applied for conscientious objector, and it took a while, and I wound up getting it, and I was in the lottery the first year they had the lottery, and they drafted to 195, and I was 199. And so I would have done alternative service, but I didn't get drafted, and I didn't do that. When I was reclassified and the lottery had passed, I committed a felony, I'm pretty sure. I tore up my draft card and mailed it in with a nasty letter, and I got reclassified in 1H. And 1H is like, you can take them any time, but you don't want to. And that's, you know, that's how that was. So anyhow, I went on strike. In high school, I was going to marry my high school sweetheart, make babies, and figure out life as you go along. I never thought about a profession. I knew I'd be good at any one of 100 things. This shows you how good a listener I am or whatever, but in the middle of summer, she said, oh, by the way, I'm going to Florida to school. She moved 3,000 miles away. I had like a week's notice, maybe two. And my idea of we're going to get married and make babies and figure out life, I mean, I never figured out money. So, good luck with that anyhow. But the point is, she was gone, and I was heartbroken. And we wrote love letters for a few months. Then her birthday was on March 11, 1968. And by that time, I was drinking and smoking pot, and I cussed her out. She wanted to join a fraternity. And I was totally insecure and jealous, of course, and that she's going to meet someone that's way more, whatever, than I am. And anyhow, so I cussed her out on the phone, and that was the end of that. And subsequently, it was just all downhill from there. I am so grateful. I wound up, got a drunk driving when I was 26 years old. I wound up in a recovery house for a couple of months. I got a job while I was in the recovery house. I was just stumbling forward in life. At one time, I was buying and selling stuff at garage sales and rummage sales and selling at the swap meet, or buying books at a garage sale and taking them to the used book dealer. And make some money and then do it again. And this one guy had a garage sale, an estate sale at his house, and he had acres in Hope Ranch, and he had 140 lemon trees. He didn't care about the lemons, but he cared about the flies. And so I bought the lemons from him for a nickel apiece and took them around to the local restaurants and the local produce people. And I was selling these lemons for like 10 cents or whatever, making, like even $10 a day or whatever. And I heard the produce mafia in Santa Barbara was wondering who's selling lemons to all the restaurants and so on. So that's just one example of countless, So I got a real job, and 2 months later, I'm sober 2 months, 26 years old. The 4th of July comes up, the whole house goes to the AA picnic, and I went to the company picnic. And I was just more connected with the company people. So I go to a company picnic, they have kegs of beer, and I hadn't drank nothing for two months, so I knew a couple of beers wouldn't hurt me. You got that, Adrian? Right? I got 2 months sober, and a couple of beers ain't gonna hurt me none. And you got that, Teresa. And Grant, you got it? Okay. 9 years went by, and I washed up, and I was the guy in the photograph. So I totally disintegrated. And that's enough of that story. So my strong suit is Alcoholics Anonymous. I washed up on these shores 20 months before I got sober, or a couple of years before I got sober. There was a woman named Laura that I was totally crazy about. She's the last woman that I was like totally crazy about, that was crazy about me. And her car was washed off the road in a storm. They found her car and they never found her. And I was totally tore up and broken heart and all that stuff. And anyhow, and I'd been drinking all along. In this last, you know, year and a half, 20 months before I got sober after she died, I was swearing it off every morning. Just not today, I'm not drinking today. And then something would come up later on and be like, oh yes, one more time. Or no, actually, the way it went, it was like, oh no, not again. Oh yes, one more time. And that's, oh, this is time to have a drink. And I would really appreciate if it was Jack Daniels or something, or if it was Michelob beer, because normally I drank Milwaukee, the cheapest beer. Okay, so one day my mom stopped by my workshop, noticing I haven't been happy for a while. Would you see this therapist? And I've been thinking about seeing a therapist. My friend Laura was married and separated when we were seeing each other. I was not spiritually or emotionally connected enough to express condolences to her parents or her ex-husband or whatever. I'd met those people. I'd met her mom, her stepdad, her real dad, her ex, someday to be ex. I didn't have any wherewithal. I'm sure there was a huge memorial for her. She was really precious. And I didn't show up. So I was, you know, a long way thinking I need to see a therapist. I need to, you know, I need to process my grief or whatever. Anyhow, so when my mom stopped by and said, we noticed you haven't been happy for a while, would you see this therapist? I said, yes. And I figured I was going to need to stop drinking while I took care of my problems. And I made an appointment for the next day. And late that day, I finished the last couple of cigarettes I had, and I finished the last couple of beers I had. And I went to bed at 10 o'clock, you know, and I'm going to be like, okay, I'm going to give myself a chance at life. Like early to bed, early to rise. And I go to bed and I can't get to sleep, and I get up and I go to Safeway and I get a pint of rum and a liter of Coca-Cola and a pack of Camel Straights and come home. And from 11 to 1, I'm sitting in my living room. There's a wood crate, black and white TV there, a 19-inch TV, and a wood crate right here that's standing up tall with my ashtray and my drink. And I'm watching a movie. I can't remember what it was from 11 to 1, but from 1 o'clock to 3 o'clock on October 2nd, it was a movie called The Heart is a Lonely Hunter. And that was me. Totally resonated. The movie ended, I looked at the clock, it was 3:02 in the morning, there was just much left in my glass, nothing left in the bottle, I tipped it up and drank it. So October 2nd, 1984, I got sober, and I went and saw the therapist. I didn't get to Alcoholics Anonymous then. When I saw the therapist, we talked about my friend Laura, and I got to express my grief and share my grief, and she asked me, would you don't drink till you see me next week? Well, would you see me next week and don't drink till you see me next week? And I said yes and yes. And out of the clear blue, and it was just within me, I had not lived. I hadn't been a person who was just overflowing at any time with life, bringing to life. Yes, I brought to life, you know, I helped the sister move, or I made little leather things for people or whatever. But compared to what life beckoned from me, beckoned me to bring to life, I wasn't. So anyhow, I saw her the next week, so now I got a week sober, and she's talking about alcoholism, and maybe I'm an alcoholic, and she gives me a book to read called Under the Influence, and I read that book. And in Under the Influence, it's like the doctor's opinion was written in 1939, okay, and that's his opinion, his well-considered opinion, and it says that the alcoholic, when you have a drink, a craving kicks in, you tell yourself whatever, tell yourself I'm only have one, I'm only have two, I'm only hurting myself, whatever I tell myself, if I have a drink, that craving's going to kick in. I'm going to go where it takes me, okay? And that's why we're all here. If that wasn't the situation, if we were just here because our morals were bad, then we all just get saved, pray, huddle up, we're all good, and go have a drink to celebrate, and then do the same thing tomorrow. You know, it's that physiology. Okay, now why would I have a drink having a physiology like that? Well, that's alcoholic thinking. I call it alcoholic thinking, a lot of us do. But the idea, whatever I tell myself that allows me to have a drink. Now, my physiology is a condition, there's nothing I can do about it. My thinking, thank God, is not a condition. If my thinking was a condition, that means there's no solution and we're just all doomed. But there is a solution for alcoholic thinking, and it came to us through Bill Wilson, Dr. Bob, and our higher power, and we call it Alcoholics Anonymous because that's the name of the book. So anyhow, so she gave me a book to read called Under the Influence, and it was a scientific basis. If the doctor's opinion, if the big book was written in 1981, it would have had under the influence, or would have had the information from there. It wouldn't say it's the doctor's opinion. It says, this is what the doctor says. Okay, under the influence just totally verified it. So my point is, well, actually, before I get to my point, there's all kinds of points. She asked me to read it. Would you see me next week and read this book and don't drink till I see you? And I said, yes. So I read that book. So then I saw her, now I'm 2 weeks sober, seeing her for the third time, and she asked me to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, would I? And I said, yes. That's how I washed up on the shores of Alcoholics Anonymous. So when I got here, I already knew that alcoholism is a disease, it's progressive, and I have it. And it's critical to understand that. Because if you're goofing around with the idea, like, well, I'm not, I just had some bad luck, I got a drunk driving, whatever, you might have something deadly going on in your future. But I got the picture, and I have it. And I was surrendered because I had never lived. It wasn't like I was having troubles with my job. My job was just paying attention to what's next that I can handle, you know? And I wasn't having issues with my relationship because I didn't have a relationship. I didn't have estranged children and all that kind of stuff. So I was just blank slate. And when I got here, I experienced that it was some kind of blessing, some kind of gift, some kind of grace. And through the, like the body of Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12 steps came to life. Okay, now to me, and now we're going to get into the big book. I'm sorry Leo's not here. Hey Leo, I hope you get to listen to this sometime. So I'm opening the big book. So at the beginning of the book, forward to the first edition, the very first paragraph, it talks about where 100 people got sober and so on and so forth. But the very last sentence says, and besides, we are sure that our way of living has its advantages for all. And my point of reading that is that that's stuck in my mind. What would the 12 steps be for all? And over the years, I'll come around to that, I hope. But over the years, I've come to experience that the 12 steps were a gift to humanity, are a gift to humanity. There had just been World War I, all kinds of people slaughtering each other. The Great Depression was going on. World War II was coming soon. This is 1939 or 38 when Bill wrote the 12 steps. And he wrote them at one sitting. It's unusual for someone to write something, just sit down and out it comes. And that's inspiration, that's insight, that's a higher power at work. And so World War II is brewing, and the Hindus, the Muslims, the Christians, the Jews, the Buddhists, and the atheists are all going to be really busy slaughtering each other. And so in a way, he might have said, like, kind of like, F this, as far as those things go, not to dismiss any formalized religion. You know, if it is bringing you to a place of having love and compassion and so on and so forth. But if nothing else works, try the 12 steps, okay? Now, I grew up with an unbreakable, unshakable love of God. By the time I got here, I had disdain for God if there was a God, like God was some kind of bad joke, okay? When I got here, and it was the 12 steps on an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper, it was like, wow, that's a doorway I can walk through. My religion of growing up, Catholic, with there's a Vatican Library, Georgetown Library, Loyola Marymount, you know, just all kinds of tons and tons of, you know, Notre Dame and so on, all kinds of Catholic library. There's all this stuff to wrap your head around if you want to be really educated and all that kind of stuff about that. And it's fine if someone is called that way. But I had disdain for God if there was God. And to see that on an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper, I can do that. And it's a gate that we walk through. It opens from the side we're on. You know, the willingness to do it. Speaking of willingness, we're going to go to the spiritual appendix. You'll hear people say that We do, you know, it takes honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. And that's how we do it, H-O-W. But the reality is that in the big book, under spiritual experience and back, it says, we find that no one need have difficulty with the spirituality of the program. Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are essentials of recovery, but these are indispensable. And my point of that is that it starts with willingness. If you have some willingness, you know, my willingness to be sober is my most precious gift in life. I don't care if you're all snoring right now. I mean, I'm glad that you're not and you're paying attention. I hope I'm feeding your spirit in different ways. But willingness, you know, especially if you're new, if you have some willingness, you know, don't just keep it, but let it grow. And in so many ways, so I got here and I had willingness. And there's a thing, it's like a boys club or a men's club, probably the same thing with the women, women's club, whatever. And I was just not checked in that way, as far as the way my brain functions, you know, like just chewing the whatever about whatever and so on and so forth. You know, I could barely remember, you know, yesterday or whatever. And so to be in the mix of conversation like that, but I did know that staying sober was important, and I saw the therapist, I don't know how many weeks, and I thought the STAG, that was the meeting that people go to. I had no idea there's meetings every day, and you're blessed to be here in Santa Maria, there are meetings every day. But anyhow, so enough of, well, anyhow, okay, let's keep going. Okay, so I want to point out a few things that mean a lot to me in the big book. And that first thing is about, and besides, we're sure our way of living has its advantages for all, through Zoom meeting this, Zoom meeting that, not AA Zoom meetings. I met a woman who had done the steps through Overeaters Anonymous and Sex Anonymous, and she was like a 62-year-old lesbian that was in a rage. And when I'm on a Zoom meeting, my phone number's there, and she called me one time in a rage about resentment and anger with her ex and so on, and I helped talk her through it to bring her around to, you know, to pray for her, to have compassion, and to forgive her, and she kind of went towards that, and then she got chilled out, and then a few days later she called the same place, and then a few days later, when she was sobbing in a deep soul level, sob, just so much pain. And I'm going to cut it out of the talk if she asked me to, but she was raped when she was 4 years old by her dad. She was continuously raped till she was 13. She called me again, and I said, look, if you want me to take you through the steps, I will be happy to, but think about it for a couple of days. And she called me back, and she said, yes. Okay. And I said, did you do your resentment list in three columns or four columns? And she said, I did four columns. And I said, what was it about your dad? And she said, my part in it was that I put men off in my life and had difficult relationships with women. I shared with her, I said, I just want you to understand, I feel that a fourth column is a bad idea. You had no part in it. You shouldn't even be thinking about what part you had in that. So what would you say if you're on your harms list? Okay. And she said, I harm myself by distancing myself from men and from putting up walls with women. And she took ownership of her experience, how she reacted to the horrific thing that happened to her. She had no part in it, but she had a part in how she reacted, okay? And I love everyone in this room, and I love the experience in this room. But the way I see it, there's one paragraph in the, and this is going over the head of the newcomers, don't worry about it, but there's one paragraph that says, referring to our list again, and that's, he's talking about harms. And there's people that take it as referring to our resentment list. Earlier on, one thing it says is, to the precise extent that we permit these, and it's talking about resentments, do we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile? What I'm looking for is there's a sentence that says we're finished with our resentments. But yeah, the point being, where it says referring to our list again, and this is for people that are working on the steps with other people and stuff, is that I have my sponsees cross out referring to, and I have them write continuing with our list, because that's what he's talking about. At the eighth step in the big book, he's talking about that we did our harms list in our fourth step. And there's only one paragraph. I'll give anyone $100 if you can show me a different paragraph in the chapter 5 that talks about the harms that we did. There's just that one paragraph. And the point being, too, is that you can take it and make it my part in it, like, what harm did I do to that person? But while you're writing those harms, why not write all your harms? Because there's all kinds of harms that we did to people who resent us that are not on our resentment list. So anyhow, and it's much cleaner. Back to stuff that will help for the newcomer, because the chance to speak at a length like this is a chance to talk to the community at large, but to the newcomers especially. In chapter 5, between the 12 steps and the 3 pertinent ideas that are read, that Lee read at the start of the meeting, it says the point is that we're willing to grow along spiritual lines, and that's critical. That's the point. In doing the steps, we admit we're powerless over alcohol and that our lives are becoming manageable. And another way of saying that is I admitted that I have this physical condition that if I have a drink, a craving kicks in, it's overpowering, and I ignored my condition. And the result of that is my life's unmanageable. So I don't ignore my condition anymore, okay? But it's insane to ignore that condition. If you have it and you're toying with the idea, well, maybe I can just have a couple or whatever, or I can't wait to get out of here. It's insane to ignore that condition, okay? So it's insane to ignore the condition, okay? Which leads directly to the second step. Came to believe a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. So I am no longer ignoring my condition. I'm respecting the fact I have this condition. The problem is in my mind. You'll hear people say the disease centers in the mind. Nope, not in Big Book. I'm a Big Book guy. And by the way, in saying I'm a Big Book guy, I'm a Dr. Bob Big Book guy. You know, the 12 and 12, God bless Bill W. and Tom Powers for writing on the 12 steps and stuff. But in step 8 of the 12 and 12, they're talking about fleshing out more of our harms list. The reality, doing the steps is a really straightforward thing that you can go boom, 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 boom. Dr. Bob, he spoke in 1950 at the first international convention, and that was when they adopted the 12 traditions. And he was dying at that time. And before he died, last time he saw Bill W., he said, remember, Bill, keep it simple. And also Bill W., he analyzed businesses, and he had spreadsheets that had 17 columns, with name, address, phone, location, what kind of product, all this kind of stuff. So the idea that he wanted 4 columns, he would have done a landscape 4 columns. He wrote 3, okay? And doing 3, okay, and then doing a full harms list, and then fears and sex, history, and relationship, and then share it with your sponsor, then you're sharing their harms. You not have to, when you do your 8th step, what, do you have to go back and looking at defects of character and so on and so forth? It flows that way. You have your whole life to look back and look at, like, so I, let's see. Okay, I hurt this guy, so he hurt me. Should I hurt him or have a resentment? Well, we've been hurting each other for a while, so I think I'll retaliate. No, I'll cop a resentment. No, I want to retaliate. Okay, so that what goes in the mind of a person who hasn't done the steps. Okay, we get to the 11th step. That's the point of it. It's sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with our higher power. As we understand our higher power, praying only for knowledge of our higher power's will for us and the power to carry that out. Have on my mind, like if I have my mind on my higher power's will for me, and someone does something sideways, or like someone's snoring or whatever, yeah, I could cop the resentment or whatever and get totally sidetracked, or I can keep my mind on my higher power's will for me and keep going, okay? And the point of that is that I get through resentments in 30 seconds to a minute. At once, I pray for the person to have an abundance of God's grace in their life, and that totally changes what's going on inside of me. And even before that, I recognize my mind is on my higher power's will for me. I don't have time for resentment anyhow, but I do, they pop up, so I pray for them. I have compassion for them because they're in their shoes 24/7. From having compassion for someone that I had a resentment towards, because they're in their shoes 24/7, they're who they are, they're with themselves 24/7, where I had to deal with them for 10 minutes, I learned to have compassion for myself because I'm with myself 24/7. And having that ability, I learned to have compassion for everybody. Every human being on earth deserves compassion. They're with themselves 24/7. Even the most horrific, separated, toxic, whatever, you know, to not have compassion for them is a mistake, I think. Anyhow, so I go from prayer to compassion to forgiveness. And I grew up in a background of a prayer that says, forgive me as I forgive those who trespass against me. So I forgive 100%. So I fly through it because I don't have time for it. I became secretary of that meeting when I was 4 months sober. This is a little quick rundown of saying yes when life's put something in front of you. And so they nominated me. We had a smoking meeting in the library at the Episcopal Church on the corner of Mitchell, Trina, and State. It's this Gothic, classic, huge church. And we had their library meeting in their library, and we smoked in there. I can't imagine how it smelled. When I became secretary, we started opening the windows, and I had fans set up to blow out and stuff. Now, like I said before, I was, you know, treasurer of the central office and learned how to do spreadsheets. And now, for my business, I have products that on one spreadsheet, I have 600 rows and about 50 columns. And so on and so forth. Early in sobriety, I was walking on State Street, and there was a card table with women from shelter services. And I grabbed a flyer and I put it on the pile at my workshop where my sewing machine was. Next to the sewing machine was my pile of bills, and I put the flyer there. And a week later or so, I got a chance to buy a one-ton long van for $450. I didn't have the money, but I had the leather, and I had a friend that bought the leather for me. I got this one-ton long van, and then I'm going through this pile of stuff next to my sewing machine, and I see this thing from shelter services, and I write them a letter and say, hey, you can borrow my van anytime. I figured for sure they'd want it. And they call the next day and say, hey, Billy, we're glad to hear from you. We have a thrift store in Lompoc. We have a big storage place of stuff that needs to go up to Lompoc for the thrift store, and we'll pay for the gas if you take it up there. And I said, sure. One thing led to another, and I could easily go for another half an hour. I might go a minute over, but that's it, I promise. But that led to helping them move over to the Women's Community Building. At the Women's Community Building was the Rape Crisis Center, and the Rape Crisis Center saw this guy around slinging. So they saw me slinging sofas, and they said, hey, can you move this for us? One thing led to another, and I worked on a fundraiser for them, soliciting donations and stuff like that. And the next thing I knew, I was a site coordinator for Take Back the Night March at Delagara Plaza, so the women could be paying attention to the program, and they didn't have to think about nothing, and there was lights and sound and stage and chairs and restroom, all that stuff, and I didn't have to do it all, but I made sure it all got done, and I had AA brothers setting up chairs. We brought them in, we brought them out, borrowed them from the Alumni Club. So with that said, I'm going to share with you that there's so much ahead of you. Through the steps, clean the bugs off your windshield. Through the steps, and when your windshield's clear, you're going to see a path ahead of you. And the path that you see ahead of you, you're going to be good with that. And we all are in our own way. And however we're doing it, that works. The last thing I want to share, and thank you, Dank, is. I just want you to know that just because I'm a sober alcoholic doesn't mean I don't love to drink. Thank you, and I thank God, or higher power.
Let's give Billy thank you.